I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we're joined by author and journalist Garrett M. Graff. Garrett's brand new book comes out on Tuesday, September 10th, and it's called The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. We get to talk about this incredible book on The Short Stacks today, and there are no spoilers. Everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the show notes. Use the link to shop for the books we've discussed and read the articles we've mentioned. Plus, you'll find our social media accounts in the show notes as well, so you can always be connected to the stacks. If you love the show and want more of it, check out our Patreon page. You can support the work we're doing here and earn perks for yourself, like our virtual book club. To learn more, go to patreon.com/thestacks. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts, especially on Apple Podcasts. Okay, now it's time for our spoiler-free conversation with Garrett M. Graff. All right, you guys, I am joined today by journalist and author Garrett M. Graff. Garrett's newest book is out tomorrow, Tuesday, September 10th, and it's called The Only Plane in the Sky, an Oral History of 9/11. Garrett, welcome to the stacks.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited. So we're going to start where we always start, which is in about 30 seconds. Can you tell us about your book?
Sure. So this is the oral history of September 11th. It is 480 voices talking about their experiences on 9/11, just that one day, starting in the morning and going through the evening, coast to coast, Shanksville, New York, the Pentagon, Capitol Hill with the president on Air Force One, in the mountain bunkers around Washington, as well as air traffic controllers and school children and all sorts of other people around the country. And the goal with the book is to really capture how Americans lived 9/11, not what happened on 9/11, which we sort of all know and which we are, you know, familiar with from history, but really what it was like to experience the day.
Yeah. I mean, so I was in high school. I was a sophomore in high school on 9/11. And I'm sure whenever you talk about this book and going forward, as the book comes out in the world, everyone will tell you exactly where they were and what they were doing. But I really felt like one of the things that this book does so well is kind of capture that feeling of like, for me, it was like a lot of anxiety. I grew up in California. So it was kind of like, what's going on? Where are we? Like, what's happening now? By the time I woke up, like it was already underway, you know? And so I felt like your book does a really great job of capturing those feelings of anxiety and uncertainty, and also like terror. Like, it was really a scary day. Why did you feel compelled to tell this story, and why now?
Yeah. So I'm a journalist who covers national security, and almost all of my career, I have spent writing about the impact of 9/11, sort of all that changed thereafter. The FBI, counterterrorism, the rise of the surveillance state, the CIA, you know, the military, and so on. And I wrote for Politico magazine in 2016, which was the 15th anniversary of the attack, an oral history of being aboard Air Force One on 9/11, which is where this book actually gets its title. We're the only plane in the sky. And that I went out in that piece and interviewed 28 people who were with President Bush or around President Bush in the government that day. The president, of course, was in Sarasota, Florida, reading to a classroom of elementary school students, and then spent the day sort of hustled aboard Air Force One, trapped, you know, 7 miles above the earth in this metal tube, cut off from most of the rest of the country.
Right.
And the reaction to that piece in 2016 was astonishing. It was very quickly became the most read story in Politico's history. And I started, you know, the morning that it posted, began to get letters from people, you know, dozens the first day, ultimately hundreds of letters from readers. And two of them really stuck out in my mind. The first was from a mother who was a veteran and had two children. I think they were 7 and 9 at the time. And she said that she had printed out my article so that someday her children could read it and she could explain to them why mommy had left them to go off to war.
Wow.
And the second letter was also from another veteran. I think he was Army. And he had done 3 tours, 2 in Afghanistan, 1 in Iraq. And he was a little bit younger than you and had been in middle school in 9/11 and wrote to say that he had never understood the trauma of that day until he had read my article.
Wow.
And those two sort of experiences and reactions just really sort of rattled around in my brain in the, you know, sort of, what is this going to be like as a new generation grows up in the shadow of 9/11 and lives in the world that 9/11 created, but doesn't actually remember what the day was like? And, you know, we are, this year ends up being sort of this oddly momentous year as 9/11 slips in our national consciousness from memory to history as the first college class is starting that was born after 9/11. And we have the first American servicemen and women joining the military and being deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan this year to fight in a war that started before they were born. Which is something that America has never experienced before. You know, every single person who fought in World War II remembers Pearl Harbor. Everyone who fought in the Civil War, you know, was there for Fort Sumter, you know, sort of remembers how the war started and sort of what they were fighting for. And my goal in this book was, you know, we say never forget every year on 9/11. And what I fear that has become now is this sort of remembrance of the facts without remembering the experience. That, you know, we say, okay, never forget the 4 flights. And, you know, remember the Twin Towers, remember Shanksville, remember the Pentagon.
Right. Right.
And what we don't remember is, you know, what you experienced, what I experienced, what people experienced at the Twin Towers, what people experienced in air traffic control, which was just how terrifying and confusing that day actually was to experience, and how terrifying and confusing it was to experience if you were present at the attacks, mm-hmm. or if you were just someone waking up on the West Coast. Because we were, one of the things that sort of stands out for me is that's sort of hard to recapture until you're sort of looking at that day is, you know, now we know what was transpiring. And we know when we look back that it was all over in 102 minutes from the first crash to the collapse of the second tower. And that on 9/11, none of us knew that. And that sort of well into the middle of the afternoon, you know, people were worried about other planes in the sky. They were worried about, the second wave of the attack. You know, we know now that Al-Qaeda was never able to strike U.S. soil again. We didn't know that on 9/11. I mean, there was sort of a real fear that, like, every day going forward, there was going to be a 9/11, you know, right. That there were sleeper cells all over the country, and that, you know, 9/12 might have had a different set of attacks, you know, that 9/13 might have had its own second set of attacks. And that sort of fear and trauma drove so much of the decision making thereafter. And that now, as we live in the world decided by that fear and trauma, I think it's really important to go back and capture that day.
Right. So let me ask you, you've written other books, you're a journalist, so you are like a professional writer. Why did you want to do oral history? Why didn't you want to take everything that other people had said and write the words yourself? Like, what made you feel that oral history was the form for this story?
It's a really good question. And I don't, part of the answer is I don't really know. This is this piece just sort of sprung into my mind as an oral history. Like, it was never anything else in my mind. And part of that, I think, is because the facts of the day are so well known that, you know, we sort of don't need, I think, another retelling of the facts of the day.
Sure.
You know, there are books that have done that very well. 102 Minutes, is a classic on from right after 9/11. You know, the 9/11 Commission spent millions of dollars and years of effort writing a incredibly compelling and highly detailed and deeply accurate factual account of what transpired on 9/11.
Right.
But what I thought sort of hadn't been done was something that would, you know, tell the day as people experienced it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you're putting, I read the book, I loved it. It's amazing. And you get to the end and you get to the sources section and it's kind of broken down. You've pulled some interviews and some statements from a bunch of different places, the 9/11 Memorial Museum, you know, different sources. And then you've also conducted some of the interviews yourself. So how did you decide? Kind of, I guess basically my question is, can you take me through kind of the process of putting this book together? How did you decide who you wanted to reach out to interview yourself, whose interviews you thought kind of stood on their own based on the text that was already there? I'm assuming some people have passed away since, so that makes it easier. Mm-hmm. I know some people are people like Dick Cheney, so I don't know if you had access to him, but kind of how did it all come together in this one thing?
So I had, a really talented researcher who worked with me for about a year and a half to gather the sort of base materials of this book, and that there were a number of institutions. You named a couple of them: the 9/11 Museum in New York, the 9/11 Tribute Center, the Flight 93 National Memorial, the Pentagon Historian, the Capitol Historian, StoryCorps, C-SPAN, and other places that had the good sense right after 9/11 in the years, sometimes just weeks after 9/11, but certainly in the years after 9/11, to understand that these stories should be captured and recorded for history. So we went out at the start of this project to sort of look at what that universe was. And we found ultimately about 5,000 oral histories that existed and boiled that down sort of rather roughly to about 2,000 that sort of captured different segments of the day. And then, spent a year going through those 2,000 and coming up with what are ultimately about 480 voices in this book. And some of them are people that you follow morning to night. Some of them are people who appear just once or twice for specific moments or specific observations.
Right.
And that was, you know, that those stories, as you can imagine, are just incredibly moving and emotional and rich in their storytelling. And, I'm sure another writer who sat down with the same pile of material could have written another very good book using totally different quotes than sure. The ones that I used.
Yeah.
And then sort of as I assembled those pieces, I was looking for the pieces that were missing. One example was, there wasn't really a project that had covered the people who were in the White House bunker with Dick Cheney on 9/11. And so I went out and interviewed a number of them myself, or drew on, other interviews that had been done with someone like Dick Cheney. And then a lot of the rest of it was interviews that I wanted to fill in sort of a very specific hole in the book. Ended up going out and interviewing Porter Goss, who was a congressman who basically gaveled out Congress on 9/11, that I had sort of all of these congressional stories, but didn't actually have the guy who actually canceled Congress for the day.
Right. Okay.
And so went out and asked him to tell just sort of that one story. Another example was I went out and interviewed Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL who shot Osama bin Laden in that raid in Abbottabad in 2011, and asked him to sort of talk about both his day on 9/11 and then how he thought about 9/11 as part of the SEALs on that mission, and ended up with this sort of, to me, very surprising story that I was found very moving about how, the SEALs, as they went to go raid Abbottabad and attack bin Laden, they really thought that they were going out on a suicide mission.
Right.
They thought that they're flying deep into Pakistan, hostile territory. There was a good chance bin Laden was going to be either armed or had wired his house to explode. There was going to be, even if they successfully raided him, there was going to be no way that they were going to be able to sneak back out of Pakistan and would probably be caught and killed. And they were sort of talking about, like, well, why are we going out on this suicide mission? Mm-hmm. And they ended up talking about the people who jumped and fell from the towers on 9/11. Said, those Americans didn't sign up for a fight. They went to work that day for a normal day,
right,
and found themselves in the middle of this fight. We signed up to fight, and it's our duty to go and fight on their behalf. And that really was actually a key part of the motivation for the SEALs on the bin Laden raid.
God, so interesting. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Well, I guess, so there's one image that sticks in my mind from 9/11 that I don't think is touched on in the book, and I was curious as to why. The flag being raised on the pile, like kind of late in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. I don't think that any of that is mentioned in the book. And I wasn't sure if there was a reason for that.
There wasn't. There was no, there were sort of all sorts of things that I left out of the book for one reason or another. The book, it actually started at the first draft of this book was actually more than twice as long.
Oh my God, I want to read
it. Finished draft of it.
We need the uncut book.
Yeah. Maybe the director's edition will come out on Blu-ray at some point.
Yeah, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, you release the uncut.
Because there were just, there were just so many stories.
Right. I'm sure.
And there were so, even among the people whose story I tell in the book, there are a lot of sort of incredible details from them that I wish that I could have included in this. But sort of one of the things is also, I was looking for people who were representative in some specific way, but also who tied together as part of this collective narrative, that it was not a opportunity to, there were a lot of really interesting personal details of the attack, of people's backgrounds, of people's futures that I just didn't have room to include, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I figured it was probably along the lines of there's a bazillion stories in this book. And some of the best moments are when you have people who you're hearing from a person and then you realize that that person ran into another person on the stairwell or that they were trapped together and you kind of like tie these people together, or when you have an image that goes with the story and all of that. It was really, that stuff was really moving to me as a reader. So what do you feel like, we're going to move off the book. Normally we don't talk this much about the book, but I just really loved it. And I'm just so fascinated by how it came together. It's like such a huge undertaking. So we're going to spend more time on the book than normal. But what did you feel like maybe surprised you when you were putting this all together, and like what, like, or what did you learn? Or, you know, you work in security, like in national security, and this is something that's kind of like your bread and butter really when you boil it down. Like, but I have to imagine, in doing this process, like that maybe it changed your perspective a little bit about 9/11, or maybe you felt like the national perspective of 9/11 has changed, or can you speak to any of that?
Yeah. So one of the things, and this is, I'm really glad you asked this question, because this is, you know, in an oral history, you know, there's not much of the writer's own voice. And so you're right. I had sort of all of these observations and ideas that I don't get to put into the book, but I think are sort of interesting to draw out. And there are sort of a couple that really stood out for me. One is just realizing just how innocent America was on the morning of Tuesday, September the 11th, that we know that 9/11 changed everything. We know that, but I had really not understood, even though I was alive then, just how innocent we really were at that time. And so for me, you see that innocence in what to me is the most interesting time period of 9/11, which is the 17 minutes from 8:46 when the first plane hits the North Tower to 9:03 when the second plane hits the South Tower.
Right.
Because America sort of sees that first crash and shrugs in a way that is like totally unimaginable to us today.
Right.
That, you know, you see, and I quote these people in the book, even sort of senior national security officials at that time in the book, who are like, oh, well, that's super weird. Like, I guess there must be problems with air traffic control, or maybe the pilot had a heart attack, or, that's just super weird. And there's this quote from a New York Harbor ferry captain who talks about how they watch on the boat coming into New York Harbor, the plane hit, and they continue on to Lower Manhattan, the ferry docks. And there are literally, you know, pieces of paper fluttering down on the ferry and the passengers as they're getting off. And every single commuter that morning gets off the ferry boat and goes to work in Lower Manhattan. That sort of no one saw that crash and was like, you know what? I think I might just go home today. This just sort of seems like this isn't going to be a good day. And like people in the North Tower and the South Tower stay at their desks even after the first crash.
Right.
And then, you know, you see, you know, last month, the video of a motorcycle backfiring in Times Square.
Right.
And people run for their lives. You know, we just default now to thinking it's terrorism, thinking it's an attack, thinking it's a shooting, in a way that was literally unimaginable to us on 9/11 until that second plane hits and we sort of realize that something bad is going on.
Yeah, and you really get that sense in reading the book.
And then the other sort of big theme that stands out for me is, and this is sort of, this is just like a deeply human one, is the extent to which incredibly small meaningless decisions, the types that we make 1,000 times a day that we never think about, literally meant the difference between life and death that day. Mm. That, you know, Michael LaMonaco, the chef at Windows on the World, who would have normally been at his kitchen atop the North Tower at 8:30, stopped that morning to get a new pair of glasses at Lens Crafters, and so was late arriving to work and didn't make it before the plane crash. And 72 of his colleagues died that day, and he didn't. You have people, you know, who at the last minute switch themselves on to the hijacked planes for one reason or another, or switch off of the hijacked planes for one reason or another. Joseph Lott, who was supposed to be attending a conference at Windows on the World that morning, and was having breakfast in the Marriott Hotel at the base of the Twin Towers, and his colleague at breakfast gave him a new tie just as a gift. And he was like, oh, I'm going to go wear this tie today. And he went to go put it on, and his colleagues went on ahead to the conference, and they died and he didn't, because he decided that morning to change his tie. I found it sort of this like incredibly fascinating way that sort of fate or destiny or whatever you want to call it sort of played into, you know, how people lived or died that day.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to switch a little bit kind of to your process. One of my favorite mm-hmm. things that I always love to know is, where did you do the writing of this book? Do you sit at a desk? Are you in your home? Are you at your office? Do you go to a coffee shop? Do you have snacks and beverages? Do you have rituals that you do? Kind of like set the scene for how you get in your writing mode.
This book was a little different than my normal, process, which I'll say in a minute. My sort of normal process is I normally write at home, first thing in the morning, from about 6 a.m. to about 9 a.m. and then go on about my day. And that's, you know, the rough process that I used to write, all of my previous books. And I sort of do it in, you know, sitting at my desk, at home, you know, drinking coffee. And I like that quiet time during the morning where I don't feel like I'm missing out on something, that I, you know, email hasn't started for the day, news hasn't started for the day. This book sort of ended up being like a little bit different because my wife and I actually had our first child in the midst of it. Thank you. And so this book I actually wrote a lot of with my daughter sort of sleeping next to me on the floor of my office. And that sort of changed for this book my perspective on writing this. And I ended up dedicating the book to her in part because I, you know, was sort of watching her as I was writing and thinking about, you know, the world that she is going to inherit and, right. you know, the downstream effects of what I was writing about and how someday she will live them.
How old is she now?
So she's 14, 15 months now.
Okay. And how long total did it take you to write the book? I know you said it started kind of in 2016 as an article.
So it was 3 years from article to book. There was sort of about a year and a half or 2 years of material gathering. And then when I sort of got into the drafting of it, you know, it was, I probably spent, actually only about 3 or 4 months writing the first draft of it. And then, you know, I've lost track of how much time I've said there. But then there was, you know, 4 to 6 months of editing on the back end to narrow it down and organize it in the best possible way.
Right. And what sort of stuff were you, Garrett, human being, not author necessarily, reading or watching or consuming while you were putting this book together?
So my day job is I cover national security for Wired and other publications, and then I work with the Aspen Institute cybersecurity program. And so a lot of what my reading was during this time was unrelated national security or cybersecurity or technology books. It's actually interesting. To me, there aren't that many books that have been written about 9/11 for such a big, momentous topic.
Right.
There are, probably less than 24 books that, are commercially, that have been commercially done.
Right.
And there's an increasing amount of fiction that focuses on 9/11, Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated, obviously.
Right. No, the other one, Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close. Yeah.
That one, the other one.
The other one.
It is, obviously sort of one of the key standouts in that genre. So I read in the course of this a lot of the books about 9/11 and quote some of them and in this book, but I was somewhat surprised when I was diving into this how few books were about 9/11. And then the other thing, I was sort of simultaneously working on a big project about Vietnam. In the midst of this, a lot of my day job over the last couple of years has been covering Robert Mueller and the Russia investigation, and my second book was actually the one biography that exists of Robert Mueller, and which I wrote a decade ago. And so I went back in the midst of this and was reporting out Robert Mueller's time in Vietnam, which had me reading a lot about Vietnam. And one of the things that I was sort of playing around with in my mind was, I was born in 1981, and the Vietnam War to me has always felt like ancient history. It was decidedly history. It was something that had definitely happened in the past as I was growing up, and sort of thinking about how, if you are a teenager today, you are just as removed from 9/11 as I am from the Vietnam War. It was actually quite striking to me as I was sort of wading through these two different eras of history. And that march of time is only going to continue. If you, for someone born today, for my daughter, the 9/11 will be as removed as the Kennedy assassination was to me.
Right.
Born in 1981. And that's just sort of like a stunning way to think about history.
Right. No, you're so right. Wow. I'd never really thought about it that way, but that's so true. I guess my last real question is, for people who like your book and they're interested either maybe reading more good stuff, stuff that you thought was helpful or interesting about 9/11, or else like another book that kind of is in the same world, doesn't have to be the same topic, or maybe a great oral history that you've loved. Do you have any recommendations?
Two books sort of stand out for me on 9/11 itself that I would really recommend. The first is that 102 Minutes book that I mentioned. That was by Jim Dwyer and Kevin Flynn, and it came out pretty quickly after 9/11 and was and sort of still is probably the classic book on 9/11, but it just deals with the towers. But it's an incredibly good book. And then the second that I think is a really interesting book is it's called Touching History by Lynn Spencer. And it deals with the skies on 9/11 and sort of the pilots and the air traffic controllers and the fighter pilots on 9/11, which is a thread of my book. But Lynn's book was really helpful in navigating that. And then sort of if you like my book, although I'm not sure whether like is the right verb for the book.
It's always so hard.
Yeah. I think that there are sort of three other recent incredible works of narrative nonfiction that I would recommend. Adam Higginbotham's Midnight in Chernobyl just an incredible book. You know, as an author, you know, I was amazed at the book for sort of what he was able to uncover and sort of trying to, in my own mind, like back out, you know, how on earth do you even do the research to be able to write that sentence was incredible. And then another book from this year that I just couldn't recommend more is Patrick Radden Keefe's Say Nothing about the IRA. And the troubles in Northern Ireland, which was for me both educational and an incredible book. And then I think sort of the other narrative nonfiction, this book that that this year that just stands out to me is Casey Sepp's Furious Hours about the author of To Kill a Mockingbird and another murder case in the South that she was interested in writing about. Casey Sepp is just an incredible writer, and I sat there in awe about the books that, or the sentences that she crafted that are right. Sort of more beautiful than anything I will ever write in my life.
I love that. A good compliment combined with a slight self-deprecation. It's my jam. Well, Garrett, thank you so much for being here. Your book, The Only Plane in the Sky, comes out tomorrow, if you're listening today, which is September 10th. Thank you, Garrett, so much for being here.
Thank you so much for reading. I appreciate it.
It's so good. You guys go out and get it. It's going to take your breath away. It's pretty incredible. And everyone, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you so much for listening to The Short Stacks. And thank you again to Garrett M. Graff for being our guest. I'd also like to thank Morgan Hoyt at Avid Reader Press for setting up this interview. Make sure you get your copy of The Only Plane in the Sky wherever you get your books. Everything we talked about on today's show can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegeerajis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I will see you in the stacks.
Have you ever wondered how to say good morning in Italian? Or what is goodbye in French? You can ask Alexa. Just say, what is happy birthday in German? Or how do you say hello in Japanese? Do you want to know how to say I love you in Spanish? Ask Alexa and start learning a new language today.